Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, January 5th, 2022. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MMH, don't visit ER for COVID test. Officials urge residents to schedule appointments with drive-through sites, by Stuart Doreen. Midland health officials are asking residents to not come to the Midland Memorial Hospital emergency room for COVID testing. An increase in inpatients, including those admitted for COVID issues, along with staff numbers impacted by the latest spike, are creating issues such as longer wait times. Hospital officials said Tuesday during a press conference that the number of inpatients has increased from 30-something last week to 62 on Tuesday morning. They said 82% of the people admitted for COVID are unvaccinated and requested those needing to be tested to call 6-8-NURSE to schedule an appointment at a drive-through testing center. Please recognize that you need an appointment for testing, Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said. We can typically get you in the same day or the next day, although our capacity is really being taxed with the demand going up. Demand includes 492 positive tests reported from last week, according to the Midland Health website on Tuesday. That is the most in any one week going back at least a year. Midland Health officials also reported 70 staff members that are positive or currently quarantined. There are another 40 that have been exposed and are being monitored, according to officials. On Tuesday morning, there were 197 total inpatients occupying rooms at Midland Memorial. We've asked the state to send us some additional staff, Myers said. We've asked for over 60 nursing staff and a few respiratory therapy staff. We're hopeful of getting good response to that request here in the next few days. One reason more staff might be needed is because of a positivity rate spiking above 50%. Last week, the positivity rate at Midland Health Testing Centers was 41.5%, which was the highest in the last year by nearly 10 percentage points. Through the end of the day Monday, that rate was 51%. That meant more patients were testing positive for COVID, 178, than tested negative. Dr. Larry Wilson, Chief Medical Officer for Midland Health, reported Tuesday that he believes the Omicron variant is the reason for the greater positivity numbers. We don't have that information yet to be able to validate that specifically, Wilson said. But with the degree of transmissibility, the spread of this, and the lower degree of really sick patients that we're seeing, fortunately, it does appear to be Omicron. On Tuesday, hospital officials reported 12 of the 62 inpatients were in the critical care unit. Because the surge is so great and the transmissibility is so high, we're still seeing a high number of patients in the hospital, Wilson said. As Russell mentioned, over 60 patients in the hospital currently, and this is a number we haven't seen for a very, very long time. Generally, the hospitalizations are a little shorter, and the number that end up in critical care is less. But we do have 12 patients in critical care currently. So this is very real, and the experience is very harsh and impacting the resources of the hospital and a lot of families as well. Myers added that those wanting to be tested should also avoid going inside the F. Marie Hall Outpatient Center, formerly West Campus. Again, he worried about possible exposure issues. If you make an appointment, they'll tell you exactly where to go, Myers said. It's a drive-through process. It doesn't require you to come inside the building. One more time, please do not come to the emergency department just to be tested. If you have conditions that you believe require emergency treatment, please come. That's what the emergency room is for. We'll be happy to care for you. If you are just suspicious that you might have COVID and you want to be tested, the emergency department is not where you belong. Please do not come there and make things more difficult for those who need to be treated. Please call 68NURSE. Make an appointment and get tested in our testing center. This article is entitled, Zoning Board Approves Axe Bar. Mr. Chip's Kitchen also gets okay to move forward with plans. By Mella McEwen. Midland could soon be home to a new axe bar. On Monday, Planning and Zoning Commissioners unanimously approved a request by Michael Smith for a specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in an axe bar at 3201 West Front Street. Tall City Axe House will have total square footage of 3,627 square feet with an alcohol serviceable area of 1,833 square feet. The axe bar will have four axe throwing lanes with two targets per lane. All customers must sign a waiver whether participating in axe throwing or not, and alcohol will not be allowed in the throwing lanes. All axe throwers will be limited to two drinks, and coaches will monitor the lanes for safety. Planned hours will be from 5 to 11 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and 4 p.m. to midnight Friday, from noon to midnight on Saturday, and noon to 10 p.m. on Sunday. Commissioners also allowed Chip Height, owner of Opal's Table and the Basement, to move forward with his latest project. They unanimously approved Height's request for specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in a restaurant for his planned Mr. Chip's Kitchen in the former Basin Burger House at 607 North Colorado Street. The 5,000-square-foot restaurant with 4,386 square feet of alcohol serviceable area will operate from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and 4 to 10 p.m. Monday through Sunday. Alcohol service will be from 11 a.m. to midnight Monday through Saturday and 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sunday. In other action, commissioners revisited a request by Just a Closet No. 10 LLC for a zone change from O2 Office District to PD Planned Development District for an office center on 28 lots and a portion of a 29 lot at South Loop 250 and Graceland Drive to develop a self-storage facility. The City Council had deferred the request in December and recommended rezoning the property from O2 to PD for an office center with an underlying zoning of commercial, though self-storage will be the only commercial use allowed on the property. Samuel Leyva's plans to add a bar area to his Garrilee's Mexican restaurant at 503 East Interstate 20 got approval when commissioners approved his request for a specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in a restaurant. The vote was 6-1. Garley's plans to operate from 5:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 5:30 a.m. to 1 a.m. the next morning Friday and Saturday, and from 7:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday. Alcohol would be served from 7 a.m. to midnight Monday through Thursday, 7 a.m. to 1 a.m. the next morning Friday and Saturday, and from 10 a.m. to midnight on Sunday. Sylvia Howard received approval of her request for a zone change from HI Heavy Industrial District to SF3 Single Family Dwelling District for a lot at 610 North Tyler Street in order to build a single family residence. This article is entitled Case Counts May Lose Relevance Amid Omicron by Carla K. Johnson, AP Medical Writer. The explosive increase in U.S. coronavirus case counts is raising alarm, but some experts believe the focus should instead be on COVID-19 hospital admissions, and those aren't climbing as fast. Dr. Anthony Fauci, for one, said Sunday on ABC that with many infections causing few or no symptoms, it is much more relevant to focus on the hospitalizations as opposed to the total number of cases. Other experts argue that case counts still have value, As the super contagious Omicron variant rages across the U.S., new COVID-19 cases per day have more than tripled over the last 2 weeks, reaching a record-shattering average of 480,000. Schools, hospitals, and airlines are struggling as infected workers go into isolation. Meanwhile, hospital admissions averaged 14,800 per day last week, up 63% from the week before, but still short of the peak of 16,500 per day a year ago, when the vast majority of the U.S. was unvaccinated. Deaths have been stable over the past 2 weeks at an average of about 1,200 per day, well below the all-time high of 3,400 last January. Public health experts suspect that those numbers, taken together, reflect the vaccine's continued effectiveness at preventing serious illness, even against Omicron, as well as the possibility that the variant does not make most people as sick as earlier versions. Dr. Wafa El Sadr, director of ICAP, a global health center at Columbia University, said the case count does not appear to be the most important number now. Instead, she said, the U.S. at this stage of the pandemic should be shifting our focus, especially in the era of vaccination, to really focus on preventing illness, disability, and death, and therefore counting those. The daily case counts are subject to wild swings. The number of new cases reported on Monday topped an unprecedented 1 million, a figure that may reflect cases that had been held up by reporting delays over the holiday weekend. The 7-day rolling average is considered more reliable. The value of the daily case count is being called into question as never before. For one thing, the skyrocketing increase reflects, at least in part, an Omicron-induced stampede among many Americans to get tested before holiday gatherings, and new testing requirements at workplaces and at restaurants, theaters, and other sites. Also, the true number of infections is probably much higher than the case count because the results of the at-home tests that Americans are rushing to use are not added to the official tally, and because long waits have discouraged some people from lining up to get swabbed. But also, case numbers seem to yield a less useful picture of the pandemic amid the spread of Omicron, which is causing lots of infections, but so far does not appear to be as severe in its effects. Case counts have lost relevance, said Andrew Neumer, a public health professor at the University of California, Irvine.
Wednesday, January 5th.
Hospitalizations are where the rubber meets the road, Josephine Kerr Moberly.
It's a more objective measure.
Betty Jo Kerr Moberly was born on January 10, 1929, in El Paso, Texas, to Josephine Robinson and Joseph Neal Kerr Sr., and died peacefully December 19, 2021, in Dallas. Betty Jo is preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and her four brothers, Joe Neal Kerr, Campbell Kerr, Edward Kerr, and James Kerr, and sisters-in-law Patricia Allen Kerr, Rosella Mitchell Kerr, Totsy Adams Kerr, and Mimi Beadler Kerr. Surviving family, daughter Susan Moberly Friedman and husband Alan, daughter Mary Moberly Thompson and husband Scott. 5 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. A memorial mass to celebrate Betty Jo's life will be held at St. Anne's Catholic Church in Midland on Saturday, January 8th, at 12 noon, with a reception following at the Petroleum Club. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the charity of one's choice. Gary Doyle Campbell. Gary Doyle Campbell of Midland entered heaven on Thursday, December 30th, at the age of 75 at his home, following a lengthy illness. Gary Doyle was born on August 8, 1946, in Ballinger, to Marshall and Irma Campbell. He is preceded in death by his parents, Marshall and Irma, 2 brothers, Bob Coode and David Campbell, sister Betty Gardner and son Terry Don, as well as multiple nieces and nephews. He is survived by his loving wife Linda, his children Bobby and Shannon of Ballinger, Gordon and wife Katrina of Tomball, and his daughter Shyla of Midland. 8 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, numerous nieces and nephews, his sisters Gail Warren, Mike of Ballinger, Nancy Plunk, Jean of Midland, and Marcia Cook, Joe of Odessa. There will be a visitation for family and friends from 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, January 5th at Nally Pickle and Welt Funeral Home in Midland. A military graveside service will be held on Thursday, January 6th at 3 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. In lieu of flowers, the family request donations can be made to the American Cancer Society and Hospice of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Lynn Cook. Lynn Garland Cook, age 79, died in Fort Worth on November 20th. He was born in Detroit, Michigan, to Lynn C. and Martha Stone Cook. He is survived by his wife Marion and his sister Sharon and spouse Randy Strassel, his children Christopher Cook and Veronica, Leslie Owen and husband Jack, Nathan Cook and wife Carrie, and Beth Elizabeth Jordan, as well as many grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren. He will be greatly missed by family, friends, and co-workers. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, January 8th at 3 p.m. at Midland Country Club. The family invites all his friends and co-workers to come and celebrate his life. Memorials may be given to the American Heart Association or the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Shirley Watson Rodman. Shirley Watson Rodman, 93, of Odessa, died Wednesday, December 8th, in Odessa. Celebration of Life service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, January 7th, at First Baptist Church, Odessa. She was born July 20th, 1928, to W.A. Johnny Watson and Grace Huntley Watson in Rising Star, Texas. Shirley is survived by her husband Earl, sister Winifred Boone of Midland, son George of Oklahoma City, son Alan of Gunnison, Colorado, daughter Rosemary of Dallas, and son Noel of San Luis Obispo, California. She was blessed with 11 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, the family asked that memorial donations be made to First Baptist Church, Odessa, or an Alzheimer's Research Center of your choice. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Adeline Grace Avalar. On January 1st, 2022, our precious Adeline Grace Avalar went to be with the Lord. She was born in Lubbock on January 5th, 2021, and raised in Midland. Adeline Grace is survived by her parents, Mark and Brenda Avalar, her best big brother, Mark Ruben Avalar, grandparents Ruben Aguirre, Mark and Alicia Avalar, as well as many aunts, uncles, and cousins. She is preceded in death by her grandmother, Berlinda Aguirre, and cousin Ruben Aguirre III. The viewings for Adeline Avalar will be held on Tuesday, January 4th from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with a rosary service at 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 5th from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. with a celebration of life service at 6 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home in Midland. Adeline Grace's funeral service will be held on Thursday, January 6th at 10 a.m. at the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity, 1412 West Illinois, Midland. The burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Death notices. Jesus Auden Rubio. Jesus Auden Rubio, 47, of Midland, passed away December 31st. Viewing will be Tuesday, January 4th from 2 to 9 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home Chapel, 405 North Terrell Street. A funeral service is set for Wednesday, January 5th at 3 p.m., also at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. He is survived by his parents, Eliodoro and Maria Rubio, sons Juan Sanchez and Jesus Rubio, daughter Veronice Rubio, and his brothers Eliodoro Jr. Rubio, Juan Gabriel Rubio, Cesar Rubio, German Rubio, and Manuel Rubio.
Hello, this is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, January 5th, 2022. ECISD COVID protocols still in place by OA News. With school resuming after Christmas break and an uptick in COVID-19 cases, Ector County ISD is keeping the same protocols in place that it had at the start of the year. Chief Communications Officer Mike Adkins said cases are spiking at the end of summer vacation, so the protocols put in place at the start of the year are still relevant now because cases are spiking again. Adkins said the district is stressing good hygiene and hand washing with students. The recommendation that people wear masks inside buildings still stands, he added. If you are sick, stay home. Adkins added that testing is available again with parents' permission for students who feel sick or experience symptoms at school. Staff can also request a test if they feel ill or are experiencing symptoms. In terms of quarantining, ECISD guidelines will mesh with those from the Centers for the Disease Control. He said the biggest points to stress right now are that all the safety guidelines that are being used are still in place. If your child is sick and running a fever, keep them at home, Adkins said. ECISD suggests having children tested for COVID, and if they test positive, let the school nurse know and they will walk parents through that, Adkins said. He noted that COVID tests are not required. Virtual school is available for students who qualify, but it is a full semester commitment that requires approval from the child's principal, Adkins said. Waterways shows all facets of precious resource by Ruth Campbell. Bringing together a variety of departments, the University of Texas Permian Basin has the Waterways, an exhibit from the Smithsonian, on display in the Science and Technology Building. UTPB Associate Professor of Art Chris Stanley, Derek Katzum, Kathleen Cosper Dunnigan, Professor in the Humanities, and Michael Montes, Associate Professor, Department Chair, Chemistry, have been working together on the project, although Katzum said Stanley is the lead. With all the postponements due to COVID, Stanley said it's fairly miraculous that the exhibit got to UTPB. When those crates arrived, it was like, okay, we're getting back to that sense of normality, Stanley said. Museum on Main Street, Hometown Teams, How Sports Shaped America, also was a Stanley Katzum project in 2018. I had a vision that Dr. Katzum shared of bringing the quality of the Smithsonian to the Permian Basin, Stanley said. This show being about water, they went to their friend and colleague Montes to ask if other parts of the campus community would be interested in a show specifically on water. It's very typical for where we are right now, and we saw our city government kind of deal with water issues throughout the last year, and how our community is going to what would you call weather the storm of the cost of getting good water for the residents of the community in the millions and millions of dollars, and how tight that got politically in the discussions. And so we thought, well, what a perfect show to have, Stanley said. The exhibit is sponsored by Odessa Arts. Katsum said the water exhibit is truly interdisciplinary. Hometown heroes for involved areas such as history, sociology, and kinesiology. With water, Katsum said, it can involve many more disciplines. Because every discipline in an academic setting is going to have to deal with water issues in some way or other, whether it's historically, whether it's archaeologically, whether it's on the scientific side, and so forth. On the other hand, unless you have a hydrology program, which we don't, you don't have any discipline that just says, yeah, that's us. So it requires a lot of collaboration, which I think is the strength of what we can do, because all of our constituents' parts are so relatively small, Katsum said. He added that the College of Engineering has been supportive, as has Michael Savade, professor and chair, Department of Geosciences. It's a thematic narrative of water and what water means in society, using images, using light, but real science, using some hands-on exhibits, Katsum said. Each panel hits on a theme, but the theme itself is pretty big and covers a lot of directions. He added that the exhibits themselves flow. They're not straight. They're on this sort of wave. And so what I think it does is it allows us to think in terms of the kind of narrative that water itself creates, where it forges a path, but that path can change. If something gets in its way, it is maneuverable and moves around it. Eventually, though, it will impose its will on whatever it is that gets in the way, Katsum said. He added that the exhibit also brings to mind the hubris that made cities like Phoenix, Dubai, Los Angeles, Odessa, and Midland possible. Stanley said this past summer, Katsum had a class where students looked into historical issues with water. At one point, people thought Odessa was going to be an agricultural Garden of Eden with water coming up from windmills. In a way, their success was their failure, because the more and more people that were putting straws down and more water coming out in the water table, it eventually started to dry out on them, Stanley said. Monty said the beauty of the display is that anybody can relate to it. The show is open to the public during the hours of the Science and Technology Building, which runs from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Katsum said the exhibit is self-guided. There are these five connected, but not chronologically or in any way structurally enforced things. So you just start at one end and go to the other, and there is some interactive stuff, he said. Stanley said the exhibit is wanted in El Paso on March 3rd. We'll probably pack it up March 1st and then drive it to El Paso, Stanley said. Scott McKay, Dean of College of Arts and Science, said an exhibit like Waterways is important for an area like the Permian Basin. Water is probably one of the most pressing environmental limitations we have in all of West Texas. Without the water, there is no economic development. There is no growth. There's no quality of life. So with that comes leveraging the water with the natural resources we do have, which happens to be petroleum products. So even more important than the university, science gets involved to help the situation along. So it's nice that they were able to bring this here. It really fits in well with our mission, McKay said. More quakes rattle Basin by OA News. There were 11 quakes Sunday and Monday in the Mentone area, 80 miles west of Odessa, in Loving County, which has a population of 64. Notwithstanding the Texas Railroad Commission's order for the indefinite suspension of all deep oil and gas produced water injection in the Gardendale seismic response area, which was effective December 31st, the area has registered 23 earthquakes in the past 2 weeks, including a door-knocking one of 4.5 magnitude on the Richter scale at 8 p.m. Monday, 11 miles north of Stanton. That order followed the September order that numerous saltwater disposal wells in the Permian Basin be capped. EarthquakeTrack.com and the U.S. Geological Survey data details that one quake from a depth of 4.3 miles tied for the second strongest quake in West Texas in the past decade. Railroad Commissioner spokesman Andrew Key said Tuesday from Austin that the Oil and Gas Regulating Agency was dispatching inspectors to the Permian Basin this week. While issuing its September order, Key said the commission hoped for an immediately beneficial effect, but did not necessarily expect one. We are aware of the earthquakes and are sending inspectors to nearby saltwater disposal wells, and we will be taking any actions necessary to protect residents and the environment, Keith said. We're also working with the operators of SWDs in the northern Culbertson-Reeves seismic response area. Tommy Taylor, oil director of Fasken Oil and Ranch Incorporated and chairman of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, told the Odessa American in mid-October that the quakes are a very complex problem to solve because the source or sources of the tremors are hard to pinpoint in the San Andreas and Ellenberger formations and the Midland and Delaware basins underground. It may take up to a year before we see a reduction in the earthquakes, but hopefully the ones we feel, the threes that shake the house, will subside earlier, Taylor said. Landgraf Griffiths tout successful border visit by Royal McGregor. After a trip to Del Rio that featured a Texas Department of Public Safety security briefing on Operation Lone Star and a survey of the border by helicopter, State Republican Brooks Landgraf and Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths each called the visit a success. Landgraf and Griffiths were joined on their border visit by Congressman Austin Pfluger and State Representative Andrew Murr and Midland County Sheriff David Kreiner. Once the visit concluded, Landgraf and Griffiths, via phone, each spoke about what they experienced during their trip to Del Rio. It was a very good trip, and I'm very happy that we did it, Landgraf said. We have certainly seen some areas where we need to make some improvements, but also found some good examples of things that are working really well. Griffiths added, it was great to talk to the DPS regional director and his crew and the Border Patrol chief. Those guys are doing a great job. Landgraf, who voted to fund Operation Lone Star during this year's Texas legislature session, said border security will remain as his primary focus in 2022. Landgraf spoke highly about the efforts that Pfluger, a first-year congressman, is making at the Capitol. Landgraf also talked about the significance of making this border trip with Griffiths. It was very important for me to be on this trip with Sheriff Griffiths because he and his deputies and local law enforcement across the Permian Basin are having to deal firsthand with the problems that are resulting from the failed border policies, Landgraf said. Part of the objective here is to make sure that we are making Sheriff Griffiths and other law enforcement officers' jobs easier by having policies that reflect the problem that our country and our state are facing. Griffiths said he spoke with other law enforcement agencies during the trip, and he said they are overwhelmed at some points, and he says it's impossible for the Biden administration to lock the border down. Law enforcement is doing a great job, Griffiths said. We just need some federal help to lock the border down. They talked about people from 160 different countries that had been documented coming into our country at the state border, and that's unacceptable. When asked about the steps that need to be taken moving forward, Landgraf said that it is important that the $3 billion in funding for Operation Lone Star is allocated correctly. Operation Lone Star is set to combat the smuggling of people and drugs into Texas. A news release from the Office of the Texas Governor detailed Operation Lone Star will integrate DPS with the Texas National Guard and deploys air, ground, water, and tactical border security assets to high-threat areas to deny Mexican cartels and other smugglers the ability to move drugs and people into Texas. We learned a great deal of information, and we've made a big financial commitment in the state of Texas. But for my personal policy, we need to be very strategic about the way we are spending this money, Landgraf said. I want to make sure we are spending it in a way that maximizes and benefits border security. Seeing the operations firsthand Tuesday is giving me good information to take back to the state capitol and putting the taxpayers' money to the highest use to secure the border. Quick hits. The Sand Hills Stock Show and Rodeo. The Sand Hills Stock Show and Rodeo has been scheduled through January 15th at the Ector County Coliseum, 4201 Andrews Highway. Rodeo performances start at 7:30 p.m. Thursday. Singing Cadets Concert. The Friends of Midland Aggie Moms Club has scheduled a Singing Cadets concert at 6 p.m. Sunday at the First United Methodist Church, 300 North Main Street, Midland. Lunch and Lecture. Permian Basin Petroleum Museum, 1500 I-20, Midland, has scheduled a lunch and lecture with MOTRAN President James Beecham from 11:30 to 12:30 p.m. January 11th. Admission is free. Drinks and desserts will be provided. Hope for the Heart. Hope for the Heart, a six-week support group for adults, has scheduled its new session to begin from 3 to 5 p.m. Tuesday, January 4th through February 8th at Hospice of Odessa, 219 West 4th Street. This series of classes offers encouragement, education, and an opportunity to share your stories, struggles, and successes in a safe, compassionate place. There are no time limits on when a loss occurred or the circumstances surrounding it. There is no charge to participate. Fundraiser. The Crisis Center of West Texas will be having its biggest fundraiser of the year with Dancing with West Texas Stars 2022, which will be celebrating 7 years of dancing for a good cause. The event will take place February 5th. All proceeds from ticket sales and votes for people's favorite West Texas star will go to support the mission, which is to respond, shelter, and educate to end domestic and sexual violence in West Texas. Shrimp Fest. The Ellen Noel Art Museum will present its 35th annual Shrimp Fest fundraiser February 28th at the Ector County Coliseum, Building G, 4201 North Andrews Highway. Sponsors, early access begins at 5:30 p.m. General admission starts at 7 p.m. There will be all-you-can-eat shrimp, auction, and a raffle. Raffle items include a Kate Spade, Coach, Gucci, Brush, Mountain Outfitters, and Louis Vuitton purses. Online tickets are $50 and sale ends at noon on February 28th. After deadline tickets are $55 available at the door. Events resume Thursday at WNPAC by OA News. With its 10th anniversary underway, the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center has a lot of events coming up. Director of Marketing Jenny Van Doren said there are about 10 events in January and 12 in February. The biggest highlight coming up will be Jimmy Buffett on May 5th. This is definitely going to be a scale of proportion that we have not seen here yet in West Texas. That will have a lot of different elements to it. We look forward to celebrating our 10-year anniversary in our community with such an iconic performer. That will be, again, May 5th with Jimmy Buffett, Van Doren said. 12 comedy shows are coming up. The first 6 months of 2022 are going to be pretty stacked with a lot of comedy, and we anticipate more throughout the year. So that's kind of exciting. We haven't had quite that much comedy in 1 year, she added. Van Doren said tickets will go on sale this month, but she did not have a specific date. We are limited in capacity, so we're encouraging people to sign up for our newsletter at wagnernoel.com. On the top right-hand corner, there's a Join Newsletter button, and those folks are going to get some of the earliest access to tickets. That is one of the many perks of being our newsletter subscribers, Van Doren said. Van Doren said the number of comedy shows is an industry-wide trend. It's a lot easier for a comedy group to go on tour because there's such a limited amount of people. It's a lot easier to keep people safe while traveling from COVID, so it's a lot safer for them to just kind of get back and go on tour. And typically, too, it's a low production cost, meaning they're not coming with a five-piece band and backlights and all that kind of stuff. A lot of it is we just need the stool and the lights turned on and maybe some water. Jerry Seinfeld's joke is that you have to hydrate before you get here because there's nothing around us as far as Wagner Noel is concerned. But he'll be pleasantly surprised the next time he does come back because we've since added to our landscape with the pilot and some other new ventures are going to be coming up around our area that we look forward to, Van Doren said. Comedian George Lopez is returning. He almost always sells out. Ticket sales are doing really well for that. So both George Lopez and Joe Coy and Tom Segura, which are all in January, are fairly sold out, if not already sold out by now, she said. Rodney Carrington will be returning Thursday to the Wagner Noel. That show always sells really well. I'm sure that all of us will need a laugh after the holidays and kind of ease back into the work week by coming to see Rodney Carrington with us on that Thursday, Van Doren said. Van Doren said the venue will do the best it can to accommodate anybody who wants to perform there, as some performers aren't comfortable yet getting back on stage. For the most part, the only person specifically sought out was Buffett. All other artists and comedians, we've been fortunate that they have reached out to us to say, hey, we're coming to the area, can we perform at your venue? That's been really nice, and then we are all so excited because we have like two new country acts that are up and coming, and we don't always see up and coming on our stage. We're excited to host both Cody Jinks and the end of January the 28th and 29th. The first night is already sold out, and the second night is going fast. We're also hosting Whiskey Meyer on Saturday, March 26th. We're really excited to have some new faces of country music coming through our building as well, she said. Jason Boland and the Stranglers are also appearing with Jinx. We feel very fortunate that not only do the artists come here to perform and some come back and perform, but we're also fortunate that the Permian Basin continues to support us and allow us to entertain them. We couldn't do it without the support of our community buying tickets and coming out and seeing shows. That's something that we are happy to continue doing for as long as we can, hopefully forever, Van Doren said. Obituaries. Gary Doyle Campbell, Midland. Gary Doyle Campbell of Midland, Texas, entered heaven on Thursday, December 30th, 2021, at the age of 75, at his home following a long, lengthy illness. Gary Doyle was born on August 8, 1946, in Ballinger, Texas, to Marshall and Irma Campbell. He married his first wife in August of 1962, Linda Harmon, and they had three sons. He later married Linda Wise and raised her son as his own, Gordon Yarbrough. Gary and Linda had a daughter, Shayla Gale, that completed their family. He is preceded in death by his parents, Marshall and Irma, two brothers, Bob Cudd and David Campbell, sister, Betty Gardner, and son, Terry Don. He is survived by his loving wife, Linda, his children, Bobby and Shannon of Ballinger, Gordon and wife, Katrina of Tomball, eight grandchildren, numerous nieces, nephews, three sisters, Gail Warren of Ballinger, Texas, Nancy Plunk of Midland, and Marcia Cook of Odessa. There will be a visitation for family and friends from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, January 5th, at Natalie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. A military graveside service will be held on Thursday, January 6th at 3 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. In lieu of flowers, the family requests contributions can be made to American Cancer Society and Hospice of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Natalie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Lynn Carland Cook, Fort Worth. Lynn Carland Cook, age 79, died in Fort Worth on November 20th. He was born in Detroit, Michigan, to Lynn C. and Martha Stone Cook. He was married to his high school sweetheart, Marion E. Ermery, in 1961. They were best friends and were together for 60 years. He is survived by his wife Marion and his sister Sharon and spouse Randy Strassel, by his children Christopher Cook and Veronica, by Leslie Owen and husband Jack, by Nathan Cook and wife Carrie, and by Beth Jordan. 12 grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, January 8th at 3 p.m. at Midland Country Club. The family invites all of his friends and co-workers to come and celebrate his life. Memorials may be given to the American Heart Association or the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Shirley Watson Rodman, Odessa. Shirley Watson Rodman, 93, of Odessa, died Wednesday, December 8th in Odessa. Celebration of life service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, January 7th at First Baptist Church in Odessa. Born July 20th, 1928, to Johnny Watson and Grace Huntley. Married Earl G. Rodman, Jr. on September 1st, 1948. Their loving marriage flourished for 73 years until her passing. Shirley is survived by her husband Earl, sister Winifred Boone of Midland, son George of Oklahoma City, son, Alan of Gunnison, Colorado, daughter, Rosemary of Dallas, and son, Noel of St. Louis, California. She was blessed with 11 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren who knew her as Nana. She was preceded in death by her brother Richard A. Watson of Austin. In lieu of flowers, the family asked that memorial donations be made to First Baptist Church, Odessa, or an Alzheimer Research Center of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Natalie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home of Midland. Mary Hauser, Mimi Osborne, Odessa. Mary Mimi Hauser Osborne passed away on Tuesday, November 23rd at Orchard Park in Odessa. She was born in Amarillo on June 27, 1951 to Anna Mary and John Hauser. Mimi married Lamar in August 1978, and she became a loving stepmom to daughters Kim and Dawn. Left to cherish her memory are her stepdaughters Kimberly Osborne Hudson and Dawn Osborne Nagayama, with her sons-in-laws Rick and Larry, and three grandsons, her sister-in-law Amy Hauser, her nephew Corbin Hauser, her niece Molly Hauser Drought, her brother-in-law and sister-in-law Terry and Delaney Osborne, Gary and Jenna Osborne, and her nephews Jeff and Britton Osborne. Mimi is preceded by her husband Lamar Ozzie Osborne, her brother Robert Hauser, her parents, and godparents. A memorial service is planned for a future date. In lieu of flowers, please send a donation in Mimi Osborne's name to any Alzheimer's-related charity. Arrangements are under American Heritage Crematory Funeral Home of Midland. Death notices. Johnny Bess Ward Anderson, Odessa. Johnny Bess Ward Anderson, 83, of Odessa, died Friday, December 31st in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m. January 6th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens of Odessa. Jimmy Ray McCutcheon, Odessa. Jimmy Ray McCutcheon, 90, of Odessa, died Monday, December 27th in Odessa. Memorial service is scheduled for 1 p.m. Saturday, January 8th at Crescent Park Baptist Church. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Adela Larea Vasquez, Odessa. Adela Larea Vasquez, 72, of Odessa, died Monday, January 3rd. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. January 8th at St. Elizabeth and Seton Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. To aspirate or not to aspirate? Dear Dr. Roach, would it be reasonable for me to ask the tech to aspirate the plunger when I go for a vaccine? I understand that the veins in the shoulder are rarely accessible to an IM needle, but still, I would not mind the extra 5 to 10 seconds of discomfort while the tech looks to see if blood has appeared because the needle is in a vein. And I have heard it is desirable to keep the COVID vaccine in a particular spot. If the tech refuses, do I walk away and try elsewhere? Answer. I was taught to aspirate, that is, pull back on the plunger of the syringe for a second, prior to injecting the vaccine. This is no longer recommended as there aren't any large veins in the recommended part of the deltoid muscle for a vaccine to be injected, which matches my experience of never seeing a flashback of blood in thousands of injections. There is essentially no benefit to doing the aspiration, so I would recommend you not worrying about it. However, my experience is also that some people still worry, even when I advise them not to, and asking your medical professional to aspirate is fine. It's not dangerous, and if it's worth the peace of mind for a couple of seconds of discomfort, it shouldn't be a problem. You would want to find someone who was trained in the old technique.
This is the Dear Abby column. Parents wonder if son's friendship may be more. Dear Abby, my preteen son is friends with a boy I don't quite approve of, but I understand that sometimes bad decisions lead to future wisdom. When I can, I allow the friend to come to our house to hang out with my son because this friend allegedly has a difficult home life. During this last visit, I noticed them hanging out a little physically closer than usual. They shared the same recliner to play video games, talked to each other using gamer tags and the like, and had what I assume were numerous inside jokes. My husband and I would never belittle, degrade, or denounce our children for being gay. We know we're from a bygone era, and we do not assume our particular values are held by our children. We have discussed it and know how to approach it from our perspective if our son announces his orientation. I'm not even certain my perception of his closeness with his friend is accurate. My husband is more worldly than I am, and he says this kind of behavior is not unusual in the EU. Neither of us wants to address this ahead of anything occurring. We will love our son regardless and support him throughout our lives. I don't want to make him feel singled out by what may be usual pubescent behavior. My husband and I are in our 30s/40s. We live in an extremely rural area, and this is my son's only real friend. Any insight would be appreciated. Signed, Wondering on the Farm. Dear Wondering, you may be jumping to conclusions unnecessarily. Sitting close to play video games and sharing inside jokes with a best friend are not necessarily signs of being gay. It is what best friends that age do. Whatever your boy's sexual orientation may be, you say you will love and support him regardless, so this shouldn't be a problem. His sexual orientation will reveal itself in its own time. Dear Abby, please help me figure out whether I've made a major mistake. I've been dating this man, Frank, for 6 months. He has another woman in his life that he told me he's only a caregiver for. But then I learned he has been taking her to the lake and out to dinner. After that, I found out she used to be a prostitute and lived with him for a few weeks, and that he has been offered sex by her. He went into a panic when she was in the hospital, and he didn't know where she was. He swears up and down that it's me he loves, not her. Help, please. Signed, Competing in Georgia. Dear Competing, do some digging. Who is the source of the information you are being given? Is that person a reliable source, or could there be an ulterior motive? For a caregiver to go into a panic if his patient disappears would not be unusual. And while it's possible that he is driving to the lake and going out to dinner in his role as a caregiver, if the person paying the tab is him, then it's a date, and he hasn't been truthful with you. I would be interested in what you find out. Please write back and let me know. You could write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.